KALW.
I kind of felt like I needed to dress that way to be, like, seen.
A high school student reflects on expectations for Black girls.
It was where I saw people who looked like me and looked like my aunts and looked like my mom and looked like, you know, the people who I went to church with.
Today on an episode of TBH, we explore beauty standards and social media. Then we hear about a San Francisco writer's sci-fi audio drama of humans versus alien machines.
The Met, you know, showed up only with, you know, kind of friendly intentions, kind of classic, we come in peace. And it could have been great, but humanity decided that it was an easier opportunity just to kind of like, just bite the hand that feeds them, I guess.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we're dropping the newest episode of TBH, a KALW podcast made by high schoolers. In this season, we hear what it's been like for teens living through the pandemic, learning remotely, exploring gender identity, and grappling with the latest social media culture wars. I'll let the host take it from here.
This is TBH. I'm Cassidy Canner-Gomes. I'm a student at Oakland School for the Arts, and I'm a musician. This podcast is made by, about, and for teenagers, and for anybody else who wants to hear what's on our minds. Today's episode is about beauty standards and representation. Pressure to conform to beauty standards comes from everywhere: movies, magazines, and especially social media. It's hard to tell what's real and what isn't. I know for me, looking at my real everyday self after seeing heavily edited pictures everywhere has at times really hurt my self-image. During the pandemic, we were away from school, stuck at home, and spent even more time in front of our screens. For many teenagers, the images we see online make us feel worse about how we look. Our next story comes from Aria Baldinger-Williams, a sophomore at Ruth Asawa School of the Arts. She says, as a mixed-race girl, the images she sees online of Black women can be hurtful. Here's her story.
When I turned 13, I got my first smartphone. This was a few months after my school shut down at the start of the pandemic. As I entered the world of social media through YouTube and Instagram, nearly all the images I saw had a specific aesthetic or standard of beauty for Black girls. This aesthetic usually includes acrylic nails, false eyelashes, and slicked back hair. The girls who fit this image often have lighter skin and wider features, as well as hourglass figures. These online images seemed marketed as the cool or right way for Black girls to present themselves. I had seen people with this aesthetic in person, but I was also exposed to all different kinds of Black girls. But during the pandemic, the main image of Black girls I saw were on social media, like Instagram and YouTube. This is a clip from the song Conceited by Flo Milli, a well-known Black female rapper. Was this standard directed at me? Was I allowed to present myself in this way? My mother is white and my father is Black. For the entirety of my life, I've struggled to find the quote-unquote rules of being mixed.
I never know if I should say that I'm half Black because I don't know if I, like, qualify to say that.
My best friend Misha Brown is mixed race too. She lives in Sonoma County, a county that's over 85% white.
I've definitely had, like, some kids at my school have said, like, you seem very white, or you should dress more like who you are and stuff like that.
And she's seen the same images online as I have.
Well, I feel like the way that you're supposed to look is very curvy and like have small waist and big hips. And I think that the clothes, skinny jeans, like ripped, and small shirts or big t-shirts, and like biker shorts.
Misha frequently wears trendy clothes such as biker shorts, hoodies, and Jordans, and often slicks back her hair. Social media can make her feel like her hair has to be done in a specific way, almost smooth, without any frizz. That's not naturally what curly hair looks like. Labeling only slicked back hair or wigs as pretty can lead Black girls to believe that their natural hair is not good enough.
I kind of felt like I didn't know I wanted to like look that way and be that way. I wasn't sure if I like had, I don't know how to say, like the right to look that way because I'm like mixed. And I felt like since for some of my friends, like, because I mostly have white friends, and so I felt like I didn't know where they saw me and if they thought that I needed to look more one way. And I kind of felt like I needed to dress that way to be seen.
Misha's learning she doesn't have to choose between being Black or white. She can be both.
We as a society still have these sort of half stories, these incomplete narratives around different sets of people.
University of Washington professor Tamika Townsell is the author of Branding Black Womanhood, Media Citizenship from Black Power to Black Girl Magic.
It doesn't surprise me at all, Aria, that you often feel like your particular identity isn't reflected. I think a lot of people feel like that.
Townsell grew up in Detroit and remembers trips to the hair salon as part of the ritual of growing up. Getting her hair done was like being with family. She especially remembers reading Essence magazine, a fashion magazine marketed toward Black women.
It was where I saw people who looked like me and looked like my aunts and looked like my mom and looked like, you know, the people who I went to church with. And so it felt familiar. And it felt comforting, I think, because of that. And I think eventually it became sort of an aspirational thing. This is what I'm supposed to become. This is a script.
But in those magazines she read, she also saw a pattern in how Black women were portrayed.
They usually had straight hair. And they were always professionals, often mothers. If they were married, it was almost always to a Black man. And so it was a very narrow, almost like a Claire Huxtable type of vibe. I know the Cosby Show has sort of faded for multiple reasons, but for a long time, a lot of the images that were centered in Black print culture in terms of Black womanhood, Claire Huxtable encapsulates in a lot of ways what that was. You can think about it now as like a Michelle Obama, I think is probably a more contemporary sort of mainstream, very respectable image of Black womanhood.
As she got older, she consumed more types of media.
When you think about something like hip-hop, you saw lots of different kinds of images of Black femininity come into play there. Come on, is it worth it? Let me work it. I put my thing down, flip it and
reverse it. It's your primitive, it's when yet. It's your primitive, it's when yet. And Townsell says social media has amplified the conversation around beauty in Black communities and elsewhere.
I think that Black beauty, kind of like Black media, is always something that's endangered and contested. Black and beauty in the Western world are antithetical, you know? And so you still see, whether it be social media or other platforms, you still see a lot of times the same sort of body types being glamorized and celebrated and other body types being marginalized. And I do think that we're having a moment right now where we're seeing particularly fat Black bodies being more embraced.
But she says that's because certain industries have figured out how to profit off of different kinds of images. Take Lizzo and her show Watch Out for the Big Girls.
Let's go!
Give it up for the baddest bitch on the planet.
Lizzo!
Work, ladies.
Step your p***y up. This is about dancing. Great till they gotta be
great. Don't take there are corporations have decided that, oh, The people who look like Lizzo, we need their money too. So you have, and her show, of course, is on, you know, a streaming platform. And so I don't know that a show like that would ever be on network television. So in that sense, a sort of digital space has allowed for an expanded conversation, but it's very, I think, momentary, it's temporary, and it's ultimately limited.
So where do I fit in? I decided to talk to my dad, Renard Williams, because he spends a lot of time on social media, and because he's raising me, a mixed daughter.
We've all seen the stereotypes of Black women being loud, and weaves, you know, very disrespectful, not so intelligent, big old booties. Those are the stereotypes that in a person who reads comics, who's into, you know, literature back in the days, movies, like, you know, most people, those are the things I used to see growing up, but weren't really what I would see in my real life.
Growing up in San Francisco, he says, the Black women in his life portrayed themselves differently than the images he saw in comic books or movies.
There was a lot more, you know, right on, power, Black is beautiful type of thing, where you wouldn't be caught dead with pressed hair and preppy tie and, like, trying to act a certain way.
I showed him an image of the rapper Saweetie, a popular Black female artist who often wears wigs or slicked back hair, false lashes, and acrylic nails. She's an example of the baddie image.
Yeah, I've seen that look. Fake this, fake that. I much prefer the natural look as I was growing up.
He had a lot of opinions.
So, do you think this standard in general is like a facade, like you're saying?
Yes, I believe depending on what medium you're looking at, it's totally a facade.
I disagree that this baddie image with fake nails and eyelashes should be considered a facade. But I understand why my dad thinks this way. It's easy to judge people based on what seems quote-unquote unnatural. People should be able to make decisions about what they want to do with their own bodies. In a perfect world, wearing fake nails or wigs should be someone's own decision. Here's my friend Misha Brown.
Not everyone is, like, perfect all the time, and that it's okay if your hair's a little frizzy, and, like, I hope that more non-people of color also understand that, because I think, like, they also see that and think that their hair's not frizzy all the time.
And here's what Tamika Townsend had to say.
I just want to see way more. I want to see way, way, way more of Black girls in particular. You know, there's a few Black girls who are sort of doing their thing, who get, like, all the deals. And I want to see that just blown up and expanded way, way, way more.
As a mixed-race girl, I struggle to know where I fit, especially whether or not I can portray myself in this baddie image. Considering one aesthetic as the right or cool way of looking is harmful to Black and mixed girls. And we need to make room for personal expression to be accepted and celebrated, in person and on social media.
That story was produced by Aria Baldinger Williams, a sophomore at Ruth Asawa School of the Arts. We're airing new TBH episodes every week. Find them on your podcast player or at kalw.org/TBH. Thank you. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. San Francisco screenwriter Gary Whitta seems to have a common theme throughout his writing, the resilience of the human spirit. Whitta wrote the screenplay for The Book of Eli and co-wrote Rogue One, a Star Wars story. His latest project is the sci-fi audio drama Gundog, where an advanced alien machine species takes over the world and enslaves people. To fight the aliens, humans build this large robot called a Gundog. The humans lose the war, and years after, the courageous lead character, Dakota, goes on a journey to find one of those long-lost Gundog robots. KALW's Janae Darden goes deeper with Gary Whitta.
I know you're a gamer. Does that influence you in your writing and in your imagination?
It kind of did when I was a kid. Back in the day, it's interesting. Like, these days, video games are known for being very story rich. You know, you can play amazing games like, you know, The Last of Us and The Walking Dead and Uncharted and these games that tell incredible stories that are, you know, as interesting as anything you'll see on film and television. But it wasn't always that way. You know, we all, like, back in the 80s when I was first playing games that didn't have much of a story, just, you know, just basically, you know, you must go kill all the robots. Like, that was pretty much it. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, like, there's got to be more to this. And I would, as I was playing the game, I would try to kind of fill in the gaps narratively and, like, kind of write the story that the game hadn't, and just in my head try to create some kind of narrative context and backstory for what was going on in the game. And that was kind of my first experience with just, you know, kind of just mental creative writing exercises. It was kind of filling in the blanks of the story for games that didn't really have much of a story.
One of your most well-known projects is Rogue One, a Star Wars story. It's loved by many fans, considered to be one of the best in the franchise, some would argue. And also, I know there's a spinoff called Andor that's been created. What does it mean to you, you know, that people are still talking about this film?
Yeah, it's really gratifying and somewhat of a relief, because I remember when Gareth Edwards, the director, and I were first working on this project back in the early days, me certainly were to different extents kind of nervous about taking on something that felt like, you know, such a, like, very high risk, high reward. You know, like, if we get this right, then, you know, we've done something amazing, right? We've created a new piece of the Star Wars canon. It's something we both grew up loving and were passionate about and really wanted to do a good job. But again, high risk as well. Like, if you don't get it right, it's a long way down, right? Like, the last thing you want to do is just be known for having made a piece of Star Wars that people don't like or is seen in any way as being a failure. So it's very gratifying to know that on our movie, it is one of those that people can actually coalesce around and for the most part agree that they really liked it. So incredibly gratifying to. I never get tired of people telling me that they like Rogue One, basically.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm not a hardcore Star Wars fan, but that movie I love. I absolutely love that movie. Let's go from film to something I love, which is audio. And Gundog, which is a novel that you adapted to an audiobook, and really it's interesting how you made it into a podcast, and each week we get a different episode of what's happening in this world where advanced alien robots called the Mech take over humanity. You know what's interesting about this?
What's that? I was listening to it. Yeah.
Okay, so first, when I heard the premise, which was like these aliens, they just wanted to share our resources because they needed water, they needed seeds, you know, because for their own nourishment, because their world, I guess something was going on with their world. Maybe they were having some climate change issues. And then, like, instead of the leaders working with them, the human leaders were greedy and tried to fight them. And then the aliens were like, you don't know who you're messing with. And it's funny because I was listening to it and I said, this is so realistic as far as human behavior. And now that these people are enslaved, what's interesting to me is that they are treated, the Mech is treating humans how humans treat each other.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really smart observation. I'm glad you picked up on that. And maybe it's kind of a a cynical view of humanity. I just think it's kind of a pragmatic one. You know, we always talk about, oh, if aliens really showed up, would they try to conquer us? Should we be afraid? I wanted to come at it from the other point of view, is like, well, you know, maybe the aliens should be afraid of us because we don't have the best history in terms of making friends, you know, even amongst ourselves. I mean, look at the terrible, you know, I'm half British and half American, and we both have, you know, pretty sketchy histories in terms of like how we treat new people that we meet, right? The terrible history of colonial conquest throughout the British Empire. And of course, the Americans don't have a great record in that regard either. And we constantly tend to be, I think, our own worst enemy and making enemies when we could just as easily be making friends amongst ourselves. And so that was, there's a bit more to it than that, because as the story unfolds, but certainly, yeah, as you come into the world, the idea is that that the Met, you know, showed up, you know, only with, you know, kind of friendly intentions, kind of classic, we come in peace. And it could have been great, but humanity decided that it was an easier opportunity just to kind of like just bite the hand that feeds them, I guess.
Yes, there's dystopian themes and some scary things going on in Gundog, but also too, it's a story of the resilience of the human spirit, even when it seems like there's no hope. And that's a common theme in much of your work. Where does that come from?
A lot of my storytelling is about standing up to bullies, strangely enough, because when I was a kid, I was a super nerdy kid and I played video games and I read, you know, comic books and was into science fiction long before it was cool, mm-hmm. right? Now, these days it's cool. You know, we can all go to, you know, comic conventions and let our freak flag fly and be proud of who we are. And, you know, in an age of, you know, Marvel Cinematic Universe and, you know, Lord of the Rings, like all that stuff's cool now, right? It's not, you don't have to feel stigmatized to be into all that nerdy and geeky stuff. When I was a kid, you know, in the 80s, I would get picked on for being into that stuff to the degree that I was. And so I kind of like pushed her. I was the kid that kind of like shoved in his locker at school and all that kind of stuff. And to this day, that still very much kind of informs my view of things. And so like even Star Wars, you know, to me, I came to the storytelling through a lens of like, this is about standing up to bullies. You know, the Empire, what is the Empire if nothing but a bully going around kind of right. terrorizing planets, you know, with their, you know, superior military might and forcing them to, you know, do as they're told. And the rebellion, you know, is like the plucky kid, you know, on the schoolyard that says, you know what, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm going to stand up to this bully and punch him in the face and see what happens. And all of my storytelling to some extent has some of that DNA in it. And Gundog certainly does, because again, it's very much kind of a classic empowerment fantasy of a character who, you know, all her life has been terrified of, you know, the mech of these kind of these alien bad guys that are so kind of technologically superior to us, rounded us all up. We don't have any freedom or agency or autonomy anymore. And you know, she finds a way, obviously, to kind of fight back.
That was writer Gary Whitta speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. You can listen to Gary's audio drama Gundog. We've got a link at klw.org. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We hear from cultural critic Brittany Luce about the excitement and challenges of her big new job.
I could only tell stories about Black culture for the rest of my career and still not be done and still not satisfy my curiosity.
Becoming the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, tomorrow at 5. Today's Cross Currents team includes Astrid Fettel, Kelby McIntosh, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.